fed up the anti-white system. The tune in to Radio Aryan.
On to our next speaker. Political correctness began in the East with the Soviet Union. It began in the West with the Nuremberg Trials. The Nuremberg Trials was utter nonsense, and so is political correctness. The Nuremberg Trials was victor's justice. The only victors of the Second World War were the Jews. And their justice is political correctness. We've been living under their political correctness ever since. Our next speaker is here to tell us all about the Nuremberg Trials. He's the world's most hard-working historian. He's the world's bravest historian. He's the world's best historian. He is David Irving! Uh-huh.
Ladies and gentlemen, I do have connections with Wales. My father used to live for many years in Pasadena. And he lived in Wales, and he died in Wales, actually. He died in Bangor. I've got to say about Stonehenge and the triliths and monoliths and megaliths. And I think that the ancient British were trying to search for the value of pi. If you think about it, there's this kind of they got into a circle and they're trying to work out what the value of pi is. I'm liable to be disproved on that. My father was he was a naval historian. He wrote a book on the Battle of Jutland. It was 100 years ago, and he and I wrote together that book. He wrote it at the same time as I was writing this book, The Destruction of the Convoy of Pico Zendine, about which I'll be talking today a little bit, very, very slightly. And that was his last book, The Battle of Jutland. And he used to write all morning, dictating into a tape recorder. And I would spend all afternoon typing up what he'd written and marvelling at his command of the English language, because he had studied English, no doubt, and he had studied Latin. Who was the person who decried the studies of Latin? Said it was useless. Now, yes, you. It's a very useful language indeed, without Latin. And he then went and lived in Pithelli the last years of his life, and he contracted cancer, and I had to go and fetch him back to London for the investigation, and the doctors checked him out, and he came out down the steps, bouncing down the steps. He said, "They've given me a clean bill of health." He says, "There's nothing wrong with me." But I could see behind him the doctor beckoning me aside to talk to me privately. And he was taken to Bangor General Hospital, I think. Bangor General Hospital, he said, "Oh, not Bangor, Bangor. We only come out of Bangor feet first." That's a bad reflection on the NHS. He died a few weeks later, came out of feet first out of Bangor General Hospital. And it's a bitter reflection that they took him in a coffin, in a procession, and through little villages of Wales, his final resting place, he was buried at sea. The coffin was draped in a Union Jack, a Union flag as it's called, as we passed through a little village somewhere. A policeman on point duty spotted the flag and saluted. Something that I never forget about Wales. And you know, the remembrance of Wales is partly connected with this convoy, partly the destruction of the convoy of Pico 17 when the book was finally published in England. We ended up with a libel action brought against us by an Englishman, a naval officer, Jackie Broome. He took libel action against us. 1970, we lost that, went down, paid £48,000, Castle's, the publishers, and myself, to Captain Broome, and he was put up to it, actually not by his own, it's not actually his own, he was put up to it by an English journalist, a man who the older members of this audience may remember. man called Godfrey Wynne. Godfrey Wynne, yes. Godfrey Wynne, I went to visit him once in Brighton, and he was wearing a pink puffy Angora pullover, very, very pink. For a man.
And, fond of cat.
Yes. And but it was famous, a trial in 1970. That's all those years ago, 1970, in the High Court, and it went very, until who knows what happened then, halfway through the trial. We were invaded by your lot. The Welsh Nationalists invaded us in the High Court. A dozen Welsh Nationalists invaded us and stood up and screamed slogans in Welsh, which of course the judge didn't pay much attention to. And he waited very patiently for these Welsh Nationalists to stop their little demonstration until they were then sent for the bailiff to take these gentlemen out. And they were taken out, and then he said, had them brought before me. They were brought before them one at a time, and they were sentenced to prison. I think 4 weeks in prison. And I mean, God, that's what they did it for the news value. And there was a big trial that they were breaking up, and that was. And the only other thing which I remember very clearly, 1956, that dates me. Anirin Bevan, Nibavan, he spoke in Trafalgar Square on the Suez Crisis in October 1956. In November 1956, he spoke in Trafalgar Square in London. A huge, huge audience. He was a wonderful speaker. The Welsh are wonderful. They're wonderful speakers. He spoke very well, and he made enormous fun about Anthony Eden and his so-called police action. It wasn't a war, it wasn't a military action, it wasn't anything else, but just a police action. So it didn't contravene any laws of war. That was Nibavan. If you ever see a photograph of that huge crowd in Trafalgar Square, one day you'll be able to pick out this very young student, David Irving, listening to Nibavan, absolutely enthralled by his spellbinding oratory. That was in the closing years of his life. And he's typical of how the British have a habit of keeping the really capable politicians out of office. And this is one thing the British are very good at. The really capable politicians who stand up for their country and are capable of doing something, the British see to it that they never get anywhere. That's stuck in my mind. As a lesson, just the same as my father's lesson to me, also stuck in my mind. A few years earlier, he said, David, you've got to remember, my boy, British justice is the best that money can buy. Well, that also comes up since then. The Lipstadt trial, Deborah Lipstadt, in the year 2000, cost her $13 million. She paid $13 million in her court costs to have all the best lawyers. Best lawyers and barristers and the best historians and the not so best historians and somewhat less historians and all their assistants and students in court to testify against me in the Lipstadt trial, which I was bringing against her in for libel. And I remember Professor Evans was there. It's a Welsh name, Evans, but he denied being Welsh because. Actually, I asked him in the witness box if he was Welsh, and he denied indignantly being Welsh. He was Professor Richard Evans. He didn't know who Albert Speer was. He didn't know who Otto Arnold, he did any of these big Nazis. He didn't recognize. I find a historian he was. Which takes me back to the subject of this the book. What we're talking about today, it's a funeral. My books often begin with funerals. Funerals have the advantage that they're all kind of gathered around the gravesite, and you can have the people at the funeral paying homage to the man who's being buried, and around the gravesite, or having marched in the procession to his grave, are all those who are bringing up. They're all the big names of his career. So a funeral is a very... I've begun 4 or 5 of my books over my writing career with funerals, oddly enough. I recognize, the Sikorsky book, Sikorsky, 1967, I wrote that begins with Sikorsky's funeral. And you realize then you're making a habit of that. In a sense, this book begins with the funeral. It's a book about this man, Robert H. Jackson. It's my book on the Nuremberg trials, from £20, sorry, reduction offer, special offer today, £20. Justice Robert H. Jackson, there he is in this photograph. He is making his opening speech in the Nuremberg trials. That's him standing there, this white man. his book begins, in a sense, with his death. Robert H. Jackson is my great my hero. He's my hero because he's white and he's American. He's coming in there as a lawyer, so everything's militating against him, except he wasn't really a lawyer. He didn't study law. He'd never been to law school like all the big lawyers. But he made a name for himself as a lawyer. He worked his way up, pulled himself up by his bootstraps. He worked his way up in the legal system. He had defended two notorious anarchists, Sacco and Vanzetti, successfully, and he defended trade unionists various reasons that the American public knew the name Robert H. Jackson. And so by the time the book begins, he's actually a Supreme Court Justice. In fact, he would have risen to the highest position in the American legal profession. He would have become chief of the justices of the Supreme Court if that had not been for this trial, which kind of blotted his career. I rather like Robert H. Jackson. It's a pity how he died. I had to ask his son this halfway through writing the book. I had to ask the son, is it true about how your father died? He died naked in the arms of a prostitute and had to be carried out of the hotel where this incident had happened, presumably before they'd reached complete satisfaction. And the body was carried out naked out of the... It's completely true, I'm not making this up, out of the Hotel Sherbrooke in Washington and dumped in the back of an empty taxi cab for the taxi driver to find and scratch his head about how that body had managed to get into his cab in a state of undress. And how do you ask a son if it's true how his father died? And he confirmed it, eventually. His son was William Jackson. I went to see him and we talked about various things, and he said that he had all his father's papers, which is very useful because that was what I was after. I'd written this book in two stages. The first stage was in my writing episodes for an American newspaper, an American magazine. About 5 or 6 or 7 episodes came out, and then the Jackson papers became available. I realized the Jackson papers, the papers of this man, were in 2 or 3 cases of the papers. There was record group 238 in the American National Archives, record group 238, and then the papers of Justice Jackson, which were in the Library of Congress, and I wanted to see the son because of them. He said, yes, all my father's papers are in the possession now of an American professor, law professor. His name is Philip Courland, and he was a Chicago Law School professor at the New Chicago Law School. Philip Courland. So I phoned him one day and I said, I'd like to see all these papers. Can I see them? Are you right? And he said, yes. But he never actually wrote the biography. He never got around to it. There are people like that. You get all the papers, they spend all their time getting the papers and get a wonderful collection of papers, but it takes time to write a book. My Churchill book has taken 30 years and I'm still working on volume 3. So there's this kind of problem. I don't think he ever got round to writing the biography. He said he never wrote it. But Professor Philip Courland, K-U-R-L-A-N-D, he was writing. I said, can I come and see them? He said, well, when are you planning to come over? And I said, well, I can be there in 2 weeks' time, perhaps. He said, well, 2 weeks. Oh, yes, well, no, he said, I can't see you this weekend because this weekend I'm going to be over in Cincinnati speaking or something. But my wife will be here. She can let you in. She can show you down. They're down in the basement. I said, as any Englishman would. I said, well, that's frighteningly nice and engaging and common. What's the word? It makes it very much easier for me. I'll come over next Sunday if that's okay by you, and I'll come round, and you say your wife will let me. Yeah, well, I'll come round and knock your wife up at 10 o'clock in the morning. He said, you'll do what? I'll come round and knock your wife up at 10 o'clock in the morning. Is 10 o'clock too early? He then explains bit by bit that the American phrase, knocking your wife up, does not mean what the English phrase is. So he was a bit disaffected to start with. But I went round there and walked down to his basement. It was like Aladdin's cave. Now, I've only had this experience 2 or 3 times in my life, walking down into a basement and opening filing cabinets of completely unexplained, unexplored materials, apart from him. He obviously dipped into them and see what they were, but I've not got round to writing the book. So I opened these filing cabinets up, beginning with the bottom drawer, professional If you're a professional thief, as I am, then you will begin with the bottom drawer first, and then the next one, and then the one. You see, you know what professional thieves are like. Yes, professional thieves, they would start at the top drawer, and then they'd have to close it again to get to the one underneath. If they start at the bottom drawer, then they can just very rapidly open all the drawers simultaneously. So that's what marks us out as being professional drawer openers. And this filing cabinet, I only once before, Friedrich Lindemann, Lord Chargill, he was Churchill's scientific advisor. He was attached to Churchill's office as his scientific advisor, as his, also his economic advisor, as his kind of guru, Friedrich Lindemann. He wasn't actually Jewish. He was German, but not Jewish. He was born in Metz in the Alsace. And Lindemann is one of those characters I'd like to meet one day. People often ask me who I want to meet when the time comes. In fact, it becomes more frequent now, getting letters about when the time comes, than I used to get in the old days. Who is this person you want to meet? Now, my first thought is, I'd be interested in meeting Lord Chargill. The one or two things I'd like to ask him. Down there perhaps, you're not quite sure where he is now. Lord Chargill. I was reading a biography of Lord Chargill, written by a man called Roy Harrod. He wrote books, must have been about the 1950s. Roy Harrod wrote a book about Lord Chargill called The Prof. The Prof. See, the Prof is one of these people, if Winston would ask him a question like, Prof, tell me, this champagne we're taking today, if we count all the bottles that we've drunk of champagne over the last few years, how high would the watermark in this room go, do you think? And the Prof would get out his slide. I'd say slide rule. Do you know what a slide rule is now, gentlemen? I don't know what it's like. He would get out a slide rule and work out. It's about 13 inches, not very high, Winston. He's that kind of man. Roy Harrod wrote in this book, he said, I'm indebted to Oxford University for giving me access to the papers of Lord Chargill in Nuffield College. All his papers were in the library of Nuffield College, in private hands. So I wrote to the librarian at Nuffield College, and he said, that's okay, my boy, well, come down any day, we'll be happy to show you these papers and come and look at them. So I went to have a look at the Lord Chargill papers, and when I went to the librarian said, well, straight away, yes, that's okay. He says, well, you'll find them down in the basement. Here are the keys. They're down in the basement, down through the third door over there, downstairs. Turn on the lights. We close it, Pfizer. Turn out the lights and make sure you... That's the kind of situation it was. I walked down into the basement, Nuffield College, and opened the filing cabinets. I find it incredible. They're full of the most secret papers. They're full of cabinet minutes. This is about 1960. It's full of... There was a 50-year rule in those days. They're full of cabinet minutes, full of defense committee minutes, full of files with names like the Morgenthau Plan, Tube Alloys, which was the British equivalent of the Manhattan Project, the defense committee minutes, Allied post-war policy, this kind of thing. It's absolute. I was a beginner. So I checked into a local hotel for 3 or 4 days, and I bought a tape recorder. Do I have to explain tape recorder? Tape recorders. Okay. I could dictate onto the tape, and nowadays you'd do it all in a little thing about the size of a watch, a wristwatch, which would hold everything. But that was a big tape recorder with reel-to-reel tape, and I dictated 250,000 words in the next 3 or 4 days. Because that was the backbone of the next 3 or 4 books I wrote. That was the most extraordinary. There's the Morgenthau Plan, the book. I don't have it on the table, but I've got the Morgenthau Plan. That's one book straight away. The Mayor's Nest, which is the German rocket program. The Virus House, which is the German toy program. We had the Virus House. Yes, we had the Virus House. So all these books are based entirely on what Lord Chargill, his papers had said. In fact, by reading these papers, I was looking at these, thinking any moment now there's going to become pounding feet on the steps. I mean, it's been a terrible mistake, Mr. Irving. Forget everything you've read. We're going to close. And I had to go slam, slam, slam on the drawers. It didn't happen. I'm sitting there reading, and I'm realizing that this English document I'm reading is a translation of a German signal, which I was reading only a week ago in German, in the German archives. How the British got it. And the penny gradually drops that we were decoding the German messages. This is 1960. it was the beginning of the Bletchley Park secret. I knew all about Bletchley Park long before it became public. So things like, in fact, I put it in my book, The Mare's Nest. The opening chapter is called The Enigma. And I was called up to the Cabinet Office Historical Section to attend a meeting of august and very serious-looking men sitting around the table. Didn't know who it was. Captain, going into the Cabinet Office, I'd taken the precaution of being a pretty impertinent young. I was looking at the registry, the guest register that I signed myself in. There's one signature, that's very odd. Jeffrey Evans, GCHQ, security officer. That doesn't mean anything to me. GCHQ didn't mean anything to me. GCHQ was one of those things that was subject to what is called a D-notice. We don't know D-notice anymore. Defense Committee notice. Things that editors were not, they might know, but not allowed to print. D-notice. These are all things out of the past. GCHQ was, I mean, now everybody knows GCHQ, but in those days nobody knew what I thought was security officer, GCHQ. He's sitting across the table from me and says, Mr. Irby, take strong exception to use the word enigma, extremely strong exception to use the word ultra in this chapter of yours. They actually raided me, three gentlemen in raincoats had turned up one morning and seized the chapter, simultaneously raided the publishers and seized the book, because the book had been read by the Cabinet Office. In fact, Jeffrey Evans turned out the GCHQ man, who says, Mr. Irby, not only take strong exception, but we're appealing to you not to publish it. We're appealing to your sense of honour as an English gentleman, which is about as low as you can get. Because, I mean, they know that English gentleman, if there's an English gentleman, then he has a sense of honour, and he's going to, but of course it wouldn't work now, because we English gentlemen are very much a minority of minority. Wales probably is there something in the Welsh Constitution which there probably is against the English gentleman? You're not allowed the English gentleman anymore. You know, I don't know if they have Welsh gentlemen. There'll be strange words in Welsh. When you drive into Wales, it's a nightmare. You're trying to work out what is that long word beneath the word services. Is it just you look it up on the GPS and you realise that it's actually the Welsh for services? Why they don't print it in a different colour, preferably one that would blend into the background, I don't know. With Wales, they think they've got to have equal rights for the language. And it's the same in Scotland as well, isn't it? You come out of Inverness Airport and you're met straight away with a sign saying in Gaelic, the Gaelic language equivalent, and it's just for 30,000 people in Scotland who can understand Gaelic. So he said, beating my sense of honour as an English gentleman, we're not going to publish that. And I fell for it, and I, as a patriot too, also. And apparently I also said, in those days, the director of the scientific intelligence at the Air Ministry, a man called Professor R.B. Jones, who lived in Aberdeen, used to visit me. And he said that he once asked me on a road journey from Mayfair in central London to Heathrow Airport. I was driving him, and I had the record. I could do it in 9 minutes from Mayfair to Heathrow Airport. 9 minutes. Yes, I could do it. And I did it, and I took him. I deposited him back in Heathrow Airport, and he asked me during that brief journey, what had prevented me from publishing what I knew? Because he said, you realise you had an international scoop at the time about Bletchley Park. Nobody else was allowed to publish it. We couldn't touch you because you never signed the Official Secrets Act, and that's what the Cabinet was frightened of. So isn't time. So I digress. So I'm now in this Professor Courland's basement, going down to have a look at his Jackson papers. Professor Courland. I opened the cabinets, as said, beginning at the bottom, working my way up, and I'm putting out documents at random and looking at them. And the strange thing, I mean, the OSS is the forerunner of the CIA. They wanted to run the Nuremberg trials in 1945, and they said to Jackson, maybe we can finish this trial very quickly. And Jackson said, oh, how long do you think it'll take? Oh, well, it'll be 2 weeks tops, 2 weeks for all the defendants. Jackson said quite plainly to the OSS, well, I think it's going to take rather longer than 2 weeks. In fact, it took nearly a year. He went to England in June 1945, having been given the job as the chief prosecuting officer of the United States, and talked with his English colleagues, and he found his great great consternation that the English had a different approach to the trials. They just wanted to kill all the criminals as they caught them, beginning with the Lord Chancellor, Sir John Simon, who was a liberal, and Anthony Eden, 1942, and Sir John Simon, Lord Chancellor, and Winston Churchill. They just wanted to kill all the German war criminals as and when they caught them. No mess, no delay. I mean, people find this very difficult to believe, but you'll find it in the book. There's the actual document that Churchill was signing. I reproduce it as an illustration in the book. There it is. He's typed on Churchill's typewriter, telegram, drafter of a suggested telegram to be sent by the President and Prime Minister to Marshal Stalin in 1944, September 1944, Hyde Park, Quebec. President Roosevelt and President Churchill have both agreed this. Churchill's drafted in this telegram, 50 to 100 of the top war criminals in Germany shall be identified, and once they've been identified by an officer of general's rank, preferably of general's rank, they will be taken out and shot within 6 hours. And Roosevelt had said to Churchill, well, of course, we're going to have to get Uncle Joe's approval for this. Charles Churchill says, well, that's no problem, because I'm going to Moscow next month in October 1944, and I can get Uncle Joe's approval for this, I'm pretty certain. And he goes to Moscow in October 1940, I think it's about October the 14th or 15th, it's the Tolstoy mission, the Tolstoy conferences, codenamed Tolstoy. And that's an advantage there, because the Tolstoy conferences, there's protocols taken at the whole conference, everything that's spoken is actually recorded by the people present. And they're now in the British archives, and there's Churchill asking Stalin, here's what we propose to do. We propose to put all the war criminals we're going to stand against the wall. And Churchill, and as Stalin replied, he said, if you do that, then the world will say we're frightened to put the Germans on trial. There has to be a due process. They have to be put on trial first. Before there's any executions or any prison sentences, they have to be put on trial. Otherwise the world will say we're frightened of what they might say. It's not what you would expect. It's not what children nowadays believe Stalin would have said or done. That's what he was... There was an element of the regular man about him, and it's quite definite, is what he said. I mean, Samuel Rosenman, who was Roosevelt's legal advisor, he went over to see Churchill about this time in October, in April 1945. And he said to him, and Churchill said to him, well, I've discussed this with Uncle Joe last October, and this is the reply I got. Having stuck my neck out as far as I did, I very rapidly pulled my neck back in again, because Uncle Joe said they had to be put on trial. There had to be a trial, otherwise the world will say we're frightened of what they might say. Having stuck my neck out, that far, I had to pull my neck back in again. And Rosenman then used those words in his letter to Roosevelt on the meeting with Churchill in April 1945. So we've got two versions of it. Actually, what was said. Samuel Rosenman was the chief legal advisor of President Roosevelt. In my book, I actually described him as being a Jewish lawyer. And my American editor said, David, if the guy is a lawyer and he's Roosevelt's legal advisor and his name is Samuel Rosenman, you don't have to say he's Jewish. It's pretty obvious, but it's what makes us great writers. What we are, we cut things out in time. In these private papers of Justice Jackson, there was lots of eye-opening things. He received a lot of letters from all over America when it became known that he was going to be the chief prosecuting counsel for the Americans. He received a great fan mail. He received letters from the Americans saying, I want to be the hangman, I want to be a hangman. Do you know what happened to the hangman, the actual hangman of Nuremberg?
Sergeant Woods.
Yes, Master Sergeant Woods. Do you know what happened to him? Hanged himself. Fooling around with a noose, draped over a hook in his bathroom, whatever. I mean, these strange men with strange proclivities. There's sexual reasons for doing that, but he actually hanged himself.
Well, I think that's
what happened to a nicer guy. A lot of people felt volunteered for the job of the hangman of the guilty. I mean, Julius Streicher, who was one of the people who was one of the defendants, Julius Streicher, who was Gauleiter, Julius Streicher, who was the chief editor of Der Stürmer, a tabloid, smutty newspaper in Germany. I mean, are you going to hang all the tabloid? Oh, okay, don't answer. Because, I mean, tabloid newspaper, I don't think I have any time for them either, but hanging them was a bit steep. But anyway, he was hanged. A lot of people were hanged in Nuremberg when they finally drew up the list. The British had the first job of drawing up the list, and they could not agree who to put on the list. It was constantly changing right up to the last moment whose name is put on the list. Krupp. Put Krupp on the list. Oh, yes, that's obvious. He's a big steel magnate. He made out that he put him on the list, and they put his name down on the list until they found out that Krupp was already totally senile and totally incompetent, and you couldn't put him on trial. So they said, well, take his son then. So they put his son on his same name. Who cares? And the younger Krupp was then put on the list. A number of people selected on the list, so they'd be put on, and you acquitted, as Jackson said. It's a good thing if we can acquit one or two of the defendants, because then people will say it's been a fair trial. We'll hear more about that particular turn of mind later on. Jackson, he came to London in June 1945, and then he came again in August 1945 to take part in the conferences with the British on the actual drawing up of the Nuremberg Statute, of the London Statute. The statute would be the laws that the actual charges against the defendants. You know, a bit of a problem for Jackson. He said, look, we discovered that the British had a totally different approach to this. They had a list of names that they wanted then to fit into the laws that had been contravened, and we started the American lawyers then started with the other end of the legal procedure with laws that we could then accuse the people of having violated against. So the Americans were drawing up the laws first, and the British had a list of defendants they wanted to fit into the laws. And three or four laws were then drawn up. And the defendants were then allowed to pick whichever lawyers they wanted from a list of approved German lawyers. They were all international lawyers of great repute. Their costs were all paid by the Americans. In fact, basically an American trial. The Americans paid for the entire cost of Nuremberg. About $100 million it cost. The Palace of Justice was the only building.
Dollars at that time?
At that time, yes. It was $100 million. And the Nuremberg Palace of Justice was the only building of sufficient size, and it was still standing. So the court proceedings were then held in America. Eventually, the French and the Russians joined in. The Russians are pretty robust in their approach to trial proceedings. As you can learn later from dealing with the subsequent Russian trials of the junior defendants, which were carried out, and you realize that the Russians had a very different example. In Riga, the Russians put on trial the chief of the SS, a man called Jekyll, and the army chiefs, eight people were put on trial with him there. In Riga, they were taken out one day in February, sat on the back of lorries, eight lorries, and at a signal, these eight lorries then drove off, leaving the men dangling. That's the way the Russians did it. But the actual trial proceedings are quite interesting. All the prosecution records are now in Moscow, but the proceedings with them, the defendants were actually given the chance then to question some of the witnesses, which would be unthinkable in an English or American trial. With the defendant then questioning the witness direct. In France, again, it was a different procedure. Donadieu de Fabre, who was the French judge, he was very enlightened in many respects. The defense lawyers found that they had various shortcomings to overcome. The defense lawyers then found that they had one telephone to go among the entire legal panel, whereas the prosecution lawyers found they had several telephones to each lawyer. So there were little, it wasn't really a level playing field. Then the next thing was that the defense lawyers could have the pick of the entire prosecution archives. All the archives went to Nuremberg, to the Nuremberg archives. And the prosecution had the pick of all these records and take any records they wanted. And then the defense lawyers were only allowed to work from the prosecution selection of documents. which is a very difficult impediment. For example, a Hammond-Göring conference. Göring had had it all recorded in shorthand by a stenographer verbatim, two or three shorthand versions. And then the prosecution team could pick just five or six pages, which they could cherry-pick on, which were pretty damning, pretty incriminating. Then the defense could only work on those five or six pages that had been picked. They couldn't find anything else in the records that were picked by the defendants. So you've got to remember this. When you read books that have been written in the 1950s or 60s, that they are based on the Nuremberg trials, trial records, which are only the record of the prosecution. The prosecution documents only are contained in the defense documents are not contained in the records. This is important because I had the papers, I collected the diaries of Field Marshal Milch, for example, and his papers. But once, I mean, Field Marshal Milch, he was the number two man on Hermann Göring's staff, a very short, stocky little man. Might even have had a Jewish father. I say might even have a talk about that later on if you want, afterwards, private. I don't think he did. In fact, I said in the biography I was writing with Field Marshal Milch after, I mean, because I went to see him one day. I said, I understand you've got all your diaries still. I need them for my erotic biography. And he said, oh yes, I've got all my diaries, they're upstairs. And he went upstairs and he came down carrying an old battered leather suitcase, and he opened it up. 50 or 60 little pocket notebooks in it, all the diaries that Field Marshal Milch, who was a number two man on the Hermann Göring, Battle of Britain, everything. And I said, straight away, I said, can I borrow them and take them to lunch? He said, no, you cannot. I was very crestfallen because, I mean, nobody had refused me. They'd always been slightly startled when I quoted, but at least they trusted me and I'd taken the ring and photocopied them, put them on the microphone and then sent them back to him. He said, I couldn't touch them. I said, well, what's the point of having all these wonderful diaries, writing all these wonderful diaries from 1920 until 1950, and not making them available to a historian he's got to write? He says, I'm keeping them for somebody who's going to write my biography. My hand went up instantly, and for two years I did a detour just to write his biography to get my hands on those diaries. They're very, very important diaries. And I'm sitting reading these diaries, and he describes how a court official, he gave evidence for Hermann Göring, although he wasn't exactly Göring's friend by that time in 1945-46. In fact, they were sworn enemies, but he thought that Göring was getting a rough deal, and for that reason he was prepared to make an exception for him and go and Göring's. And he writes in his diary, he said, 2 weeks later he's sitting in his cell in the witness wing, because the witnesses were held in prison along with the rest. He said he was sitting in a cell and a court official came in and gave him the transcripts of the two days that he gave evidence. And he finds out that everything has changed. That isn't what I said at all. That isn't my language. I didn't say that. I said yes, and they're saying no, translator. Well, I said at one point, when they're being questioned about violations of neutrality committed by the Nazis, and I replied to our best of our knowledge, the British prepared to do exactly the same in the violation of Norway's neutrality and other countries like that. This answer has been just vanished completely. So I was so surprised to find that these volumes, which I'd always believed were gospel, I made my first ever approach to the National Archives in America, and I wrote them a letter and I said, is there a sound recording anywhere what was said, I actually said at Nuremberg? And they replied after we got to saying, well, we have the ancient wire recordings. I mean, that. If you don't know what a tape recording is, you're not going to know what a wire recording is. It's a reel-to-reel wire recording, magnetic wire, on which is recorded the sound. And they had wire recordings, the original Nuremberg trials. They said, we can make recording, we can transfer that tape recording for the 2 days on Field Marshal Milch. And I got these tapes, these reel-to-reel tapes, big, remember, eight-inch reels. And I got them back in London, I sat listening to them. And it's quite evident to me that Field Marshal Milch's diary was correct, that all his statements had changed. Yes had become no, no had become yes, and vital statements like when he's questioned about the bombing of Rotterdam and Warsaw by the German Air Force, he replied about the bombing of Dresden. killed 100,000 people, he says. That's not the Charles Island. So, I was very disturbed by that, but in other words, the transcripts, the duplicated transcripts of the trial had been changed, had been tampered with. Which meant, of course, that the published volumes, the 42 volumes, the blue-bound volumes, had also been tampered with. So, the blue-bound volumes I'm not using the book at all. Very serious. Not only that, but also one of the lawyers had written to the chief of the FBI, a man called J. Edgar Hoover, protesting that this Englishman called David Irving wants to have a look at the trial, the wire recordings, and I'm warning you, if David Irving gets his hands on these wire recordings, then there's a serious danger that he will either seize or destroy these wire recordings, and I'm appealing that you do not, the National Archives are not allowed to see, show him these. His name was Robert Kempner. Robert Kempner was a Jew who had previously worked for Germany. Jackson very wisely said very early on in this trial, he said, I asked that I should not have to employ Jews on my team. He said, I thought I wanted the Jews kept out because I didn't want this trial to get the reputation as being a Jewish vendetta against the Germans. So I wanted to have no Jews. One of the statements he made in his oral history, which he gave to a couple of historians on Columbia University Oral History Project, and which the Jackson family allowed me to use, is volume 8 of the Jackson papers. He wasn't successful. Eventually he was forced to have Jews on his team. They got some kind of clout that you and I can't understand what that clout is, but they managed to get about half a dozen Jews onto the Jackson prosecution team. Sidney Alderman was one, and this is the effect. The trouble was that the consequence was that a number of the Nuremberg files began to vanish. Prosecution documents began to vanish. The famous prosecution document which Robert Kempner had seen back in 1945, a statement, it's a document from German Minister of Justice, the Reich Ministry of Justice, which quotes Adolf Hitler as having said in March 1942, the Führer wants to have the final solution, the Jewish problem postponed until after the war is over. Or was it postponed until after the war is over? No, that's missing, it's gone. The other five documents in that file, in that clip, are still there. And that particular page, this incriminating, embarrassing page, which is going to make the whole Holocaust story going to stand it on his head, it's gone. But my belief was that Lord Kempner had destroyed it, because his is the last signature on the inventory listing it. And that's the kind of thing, over the years you build up this belief that somebody's been tampering with the evidence. He wrote to the FBI, his Schlegelberger document had vanished about the Holocaust. And then there's the Rosenberg diaries. Alfred Rosenberg was a boring ideologue. He was trying to invent a new religion for the Nazi party, for the Nazi era, and he was eventually appointed the Reich Minister for the Occupied Eastern Territories in 1941. And he'd written a diary of 800 pages of handwriting, which had been partly published. The rest of it suddenly vanished. Nobody knew what happened to it. Nobody knew about it for 30 or 40 or 50 years. Until about 3 years ago, when the FBI announced there had been an FBI raid in conjunction with the ICE, which is some kind of customs enforcement agency, and a border security agency, and a SWAT team that raided a house in upstate New York, the house of an American Army professor, and found the Rosenberg diary after all, which then vanished again. Because the Holocaust Museum claimed the right, Robert Kempner had given it had been stolen by Kempner from the archives. And I had questioned him, I'd gone to see him back in Frankfurt, sometime in 1960, where he was in practice as a lawyer in Frankfurt, and I said, have you got the rest of the Rosenberg? Oh no, I don't have any, no, that's missing. And I sent somebody else to my assistant in to see him. And she asked him the same question, saying there was evidence that he had the Rosenberg. No, absolute lies. And there's an American historian, too, Anton Hock, who was the chief of the archives in the Institute of Contemporary History in Munich. He went to ask Kemp. No, he Kemp, I show you a photograph of Kemp, and you can see what he looks like. Wonderful colour photographs of the trial. There's Kemp sitting with his back to the wall. One of these men there, that photograph, colour photograph of the trial. She's kind of dark haired, saturnine. He'd been quite exceedingly key documents, the valuable documents from the Nuremberg archives, regardless of the effect on the defence. And they're gone. He'd stolen the Rosenberg diary, and he'd then eventually he bequeathed all his papers to the Holocaust Museum. The Holocaust Museum went out after Kemp had died. The Holocaust Museum then went to his house and picked out all the important documents, all the things they thought were important, and left the rest in the house. In fact, he'd given the diary to his secretary, and the secretary had then eventually given it to a new boyfriend, and it was this boyfriend's house that was then raided. That's how it turned up again. And then it would be raided, and then the Rosenberg diary, it's 800 pages of handwriting, very good handwriting. He was by that time Reich Minister for the occupied Eastern Territory, so he would know, wouldn't he, about any kind of Holocaust being carried out by the SS. And the Holocaust Museum eagerly seized the diary, and it sat on it for 3 months. And at the end of the 3 months, they had to admit defeat. There wasn't a word in the Holocaust, in the entire Rosenberg diary about the Holocaust. The Holocaust is not mentioned anywhere in the Rosenberg diaries. And I've been collaborating with the Holocaust Museum for many years, and they're very, very decent, and they've allowed me to use his many papers of his. And they then did the decent thing, having found that there's nothing of any interest to them in the Alfred Rosenberg diaries. They then released the Rosenberg diaries in public on the internet, but the most inconvenient way imaginable. They released it one page at a time, one original page in facsimile, which they released over the next few weeks. And that's what they then did. A friend of mine, he had the patience. He eventually collected all 800 pages and made them available to me. And we've put them all on my website since then. It's a very good diary. I mean, gradually, the circle is going full circle, and you're joining all the dots. Rosenberg, I mean, he was boring, and it's a very valuable diary if you're writing history. Just one example of what Kempner was up to. So, to bring the story to an end, the defendants, there are about 22 defendants, something like that, are put on trial, and some of them are going to be acquitted, and some of them get the high jump, and some of them get 10 years. Albert Speer, for example, he got 20 years in prison. Hermann Göring, who was number one of the, I mean, the British, the attitude was, everybody knows who the war criminals are. This trial was originally a total waste of time. We know who the war criminals are. We get the 50 or 100 names, they'll be taken out and shot at dawn. We don't have to discuss who they are, but, I mean, when the actual time came, when push came to shove, it was 1945, and you had this big list of names, and quite a few of these big lists of names had taken their own lives. They had evaded justice or evaded the consequences, and so they weren't there, and they were just second raters. Hermann Göring was the only big one, and he was number one on the list, and he was sentenced to death, of course, as an alternative to that. And he managed to escape justice by having a cyanide capsule smuggled to him by an American army officer who was his friend, who was Huntsman like himself. And so he committed suicide in the final day, October the 15th, 1945. Very odd. The last two or three days, Hermann Göring wrote to her driving here. Something. He wrote letters.
Well, that's the question. How do you get a cyanide capsule? It seems to be very available.
Okay, it's a good question. She had two cyanide capsules, one of which she allowed the Americans to find immediately and triumphantly, the second of which was concealed in inside a...
Yeah, but who makes them?
The odd thing is, she wrote these letters, two letters, one to the commandant at Auschwitz, a man called Andrus, and one to the Allied Control Commission. Colonel Andrus, who was the hated Colonel Andrus, very proper and pompous man. He wrote, well, of course, you would never have found the cyanide capsules. It was concealed far too cleverly for that, and you would never have found it if you searched for 1,000 years. It was concealed very, very cleverly in my cell, and you would never have found it. Which is obviously a total lie. The letter's 11th of October, he wrote the letter, which means that he gave the letters to a friend outside the cell to bring back in after he'd committed suicide, because otherwise there would be a serious risk of these letters lying around in his cell for 4 days, where they would have been seized at any time by the Americans. The Allied Control Commission, he said, well, you chaps are going to be hanging me and my fellow defendants in 4 days' time, and I'm not going to allow you to do that to me. I'm not going to allow you to treat me like a criminal and hang me like that. So you go ahead with the hangings, but without me, I won't be there. I won't be with you. It's a good letter. And it was brought in to him by Colonel Wheelis. There's a photograph of him with the colonel. And it's concealed, the cyanide capsule is concealed actually in a brass cartridge case and in a skull cap, which is concealed in a tin of hand cream, which Wheelis gives to the doctor, who then smuggles into Hermann Göring's cell on the night in question. And Göring then obviously realizes that he can't leave it too late. At any moment the hanging team may come to get him, so he's got to time it just right. The hanging team goes to get him. But the Americans carry out a court of inquiry into how he managed to do it. It's very, very detailed. The Allied Control Commission gave orders that both the court of inquiry and the actual letters would be held permanently secret, never made public, but the chairman of the archives, the director of the archives in Berlin, was a personal friend of mine. He was a little fat Jew called Richard Bauer, and he made the letters available to me. That's how we know exactly what happened. So the hanging team went to get it, Hermann Göring, where they were met by an unmistakable smell of bitter almonds coming out of the cell, and they knew that Hermann Göring had managed to commit suicide after all the last moment. Was one. And the other one, the odd business, was Hermann Schacht. Hermann Schacht was he was the there's a picture of Hermann Schacht. He was Hitler's wizard, his financial wizard. He was the man who made it all possible. He was not a Jew. He was a financial wizard. He made it all possible. Jackson said, well, that's a son of the bitch, who's responsible at all. Without this man, there would have been no wars, no nothing. Albrecht, a lawyer called Albrecht, I went to see Albrecht. I went to see Albrecht because I've been advised that Albrecht could tell me a lot about all this, and Albrecht was still alive, and he was living in New York, and he took me to lunch at the University pub. He said, you English people are pretty queer when they come out. I said, queer? Did you say queer? He said, I'm trying to get on about it. You're odd folks, aren't you? I said, well, some of them are odd, but not all of them. All of them. He said, well, there's an Englishman called. I mean, when this book came up, when the Catherine Broome action was finished, and we had to pay him £48,000 and with castles, We appealed to the Court of Appeal. And the Court of Appeal, after that, we then appealed to the House of Lords. So it went to two separate appeals. And the House of Lords then came up with the conclusions then. In their judgment, they said, well, there's no doubt at all that David Irving was greedy, conceited, and arrogant. I took the precaution to be out of England at that time. I wasn't actually in Wales either. I was out of the UK. I was in Potsdam, in Germany, in the archives in East Germany. So the Times then contacted Mrs. Irving and said that Lord Fidimore has described your husband as being very greedy, conceited, and arrogant, and what do you have to say to that? And she replied, well, he's not arrogant. I mention that because Fidimore, Albrecht said back in 1946, he said to me in the university club, you English people are a bit odd. I remember a chap who was in Nuremberg, Colonel Harry Fidimore. I said, did you say Fidimore? He said, yes, Colonel, did you know him? I said, well, I think I've crossed, is he Lord Justice? Yes, sir, he's the Lord Justice of Appeal. I said, in that case, I know exactly who you're talking about. Tell me more. He said, you Americans, you're carrying the prosecution against Hamar Shaft, aren't you? And I said, well, Hamar Shaft is one of the biggest son of a Richards, Courtney Jackson, and this guy's got to hang because he was a man made all financially possible. What's your beef then? And your feeling? Well, he answered and said, well, we would be enormously indebted to you if the prosecution can go slightly softer on Mr. Hamar Shaft, because the representation has been made to us that there's unfortunate anything untoward should happen to him. And that son of a bitch, Ralph Jackson's the view that he's for the high jump if anyone is. And so this guy, I mean, Albert, he imitated an English accent. He said, well, I mean, your guy, Fillmore, he said, well, if you can give me an indication of what the actual problem with Hamar Shaft is, that I can make representations to the justice, but I can't guarantee. Well, anyway, I said, well, I mean, representations are made to us by, Fillmore said, representations are made to us by the governor of the Bank of England, who's an old pal of his, Hamar Shaft, a guy called Montague Norman, do you know? Montague Norman has made representations to Harry, and so we've been almost grateful if there could be, if you can soft pedal the prosecution against Shaft. Well, as you know, Shaft was acquitted. It was fine. In fact, I was a bit puzzled about the acquittal of Shaft, because I found out there was one other collection of papers that I had not consulted. It was the papers of Justice Biddle. Mr. Justice Biddle, an American alternate judge. He was prosecuting. Justice Biddle's papers are in Syracuse University, the University of Syracuse, upstate New York. I went to see them. And Justice Biddle had been good enough to write complete records of what are called sentencing hearings. Sentencing hearings, which are private hearings of the judges. Private hearings of the judges, who they're meeting in private, in camera, with exclusion of journalists and reporters, no record taken, just discussing what is like prize day, what the defendants call prize day, prize giving. So they're going to discuss who gets what. And Justice Biddle said, I was particularly interested in the Hamar Shaft case, and we had an argument all day. The Russians were keen that Hamar Shaft should be hanged, and the Americans also felt that he deserved the ultimate penalty, and the French also were inclined for a steep penalty. But the British, oddly enough, the British judge said, he said he felt that Nuremberg was such a serious matter, you can't go half measures, you can't go snap on the wrist for these defendants. You're going to have to give a defendant either the maximum prison of 10 or 20 years, or acquit them, one or the other. One or the other. Jackson Biddle writes down in his papers, he said, well, it's an interesting day's discussion. I wait with great interest the continuation of the discussion tomorrow morning. He went back the following morning and found that it was already a done deal. The decision had been taken in his absence that Shaft should be acquitted. That's how it is. Except, Shaft was a Freemason. Shaft was a Freemason. The British judge who argued for him, Mr. Justice Norman Burkitt, was a Freemason. Harry Fillmore was a Freemason. He was the fourth one. There were four people in that particular thing who were all Freemasons. Which to me is, I mean, they must all have gone in with their trouser leg rolled up. So they would be recognized, giving the appropriate secret handshake to the fellow judges. And of course, the knowledge of the Freemasonry also played a role in the in the Nuremberg trials is very shocking for myself as a very young and idealistic. The reason I like Jackson is because he was an idealist. He believed you could, by law, you could litigate against countries going to war. And he really believed you could do that. He must, I mean, I don't know when he died, when his body was carried out of the hotel showroom, and I said, he would be horrified to know that the United States alone has fought 100 wars since Nuremberg, and many of them would have violated it, the norms set down at that time. I just got one other case only, and that is the case of General Alfred Yodler was an American Army commander. Very fine picture of him in giving evidence at Nuremberg in this book. At General Yodler. He's giving evidence at Nuremberg. And I knew his wife.
Louisa.
Correct. Do you know her first name? The second name, rather? Louisa Bender. Do you know what she was before? General Ludwig Beck, his secretary. General Ludwig Beck was one of the Hitler traitors who tried to bomb Hitler on July the 20th, 1944. And he ended up finding out that if you try to shoot yourself in the head like that, just at the last moment, as the bullet goes up the spout, whoop, it kicks. And so you can never kick your... got to bear that kicking in mind. But she was a nice lady, very stately lady. She lived in Munich and beaten my Ashtras, I remember, in the closing years of her life. And she wrote her letters from the Nuremberg cells. Wonderful letters. And written with a great deal of emotion and passion 2 days before the executions, because they knew when the execution was going to take place. Somehow the word had come down to go Frank, telling them exactly when the executions are going to be. And he knows he's going to... He had asked to be shot. He didn't want to be hanged because hanging was a disgraceful method of execution. Being shot was something that a soldier could stand. 2 days before his execution, Yodel had written these moving words to his wife. He said, "It's already late. The lights are going out. So when my friends finally come forward round to see you on the day," that's when he says you'll know from this, the bells tolling on St. Lawrence Church in Munich, that that's the morning. He says, "My friends come round to see you on the morning after my death. That shall be my funeral parade. On the gun carriage rests my coffin. On the gun carriage. And the entire German army is marching with me in the parade. Out in front, those who have died already in battle, and the still living are bringing up the rear." So there we are. Thank you.
The British may keep the best politicians out of office, but they can't keep the best historians out of print. David Irving.
When my Field Marshal Moose biography was complete, I gave a dinner in Düsseldorf in honor of Field Marshal Moose, and Speer came along with his wife, and all Hitler's staff were there, and the secretaries and people, and they were there. And about 20, 25 people around the table. Jochen Fest, the German historian, was there. My wife said to him, because we had in those days, you would now have a video camera, you would have actually a telephone probably taking video photographs, but we had an ancient video, a 16mm Adolf Bolex camera taking wounds. I still got someone. And she asked Hirschberg, can I have a photograph of my husband with you? And first, no problem at all. And then she said, "Well, can we have also have Field Marshal Moose, the birthday boy, who is in this picture, because it's his biography coming out?" And at this, Albert Speer froze. This was 1965, when he came on this man now. Because he didn't mind being photographed with me, but he didn't want to be photographed with fascists, like with Nazis, like Field Marshal Moose, who was his old, he was his bosom friend in the war years, and afterwards, but he Alice Bear thought he was up and coming again, and that there was a ministerial job going to be open for him, and he's... It's sad. But he was too clever by half. He was born he was born to a different generation. When I visited him after he came out of Spandau prison, I said, I guess because he was sentenced to 20 years in Spandau, must be his own surprise. I said, when he was released, I said, I expect you will have lined up, you'll have your television interviews all lined up. He said, oh yes, I'm doing big television interviews next month. He said, you know something, Mr. Irving? In all the years I've been in Spandau, of course, and now ever since the months that I've been out of Spandau, I've never watched television. I don't know what television looks like. He said, I don't want to know what television looks like, what a television interview looks like, so that I will come across completely natural when I have my first interview with television. he was calculating. He was clever. But of course, that doesn't do any good in modern Germany. All that was good is bad, and all that is bad is now good in modern Germany. It's sitting upside down, Alice Mondland. When you read my book, Morgenthau Plan, which alas is now out of print, we don't have that on the table anyway, you realize it's all part of the Morgenthau Plan, the re-education of the Germans, which has been going on ever since. When we do our bit outside Germany to keep the old versions of history, the actual version of history, what actually happened, we keep that alive. They've all been taught a new version of history now, according to the victors. And it's the victors who've written the history books.
Aren't they challenging that now? Isn't the younger generation challenging that?
The younger generation is totally brainwashed. I meet them occasionally. I met one of them in Washington State, and which is over on the other side of America, up near the Canadian border. I was speaking to the university there, about 500 or 600 students come to hear me speak, and at the end of it there was a Jewish member of the audience, and he went to ask a question, and I said, aren't you frightened that you are going to find the same kind of thing happening in the United States now as happened in America in the 1930s? You are now in all the positions occupied positions of predominance and power in the media, in the elite, in the banking industry. You Jews, yes, you're not realizing you're making the same mistakes that you made in the Weimar Republic. And aren't you frightened it may lead to a new Holocaust here in America? They don't. This female student sitting in the audience, she said, I find it completely right. I realized straight away from my accent that she was a German student. She said, that is correct. I was educated in Germany, and I know over here on a Humboldt scholarship, some kind of scholarship, rather like the scholarships we heard. And she said, I find it completely right that our government prosecutes people in Germany like you who have the wrong opinions. And you could feel the audience melting away around her. They felt, who is this strange person? That's
and
the situation.
No Germany. Difference between the West and the Eastern Germans?
It used to be very different. The East Germans had a very difficult time. For 40 years they held out. And I used to think whenever I went to Germany and lived in Berlin, I would go over to live on the East German, the communist side of East Berlin, just to support the East Germans, because they desperately needed our Western currency. I think that the East Germans had a much cleaner approach. The East German army, if you ever went to East Berlin, you would find that the East German army maintained the old traditions. When they had parades or when they changed the guard, anything like that was done immaculately. Whereas in West Germany, they were more sloppy. There was a long time when West German soldiers were allowed to wear their hair and hairnets and smoke and cigarettes and all these things. So these Germans were usually better at it.
Because I also teach German students, and I noticed some of them. I had a student from Potsdam, and I think she had a much more realistic view of the Second World War than some other German students I've met.
Yes, in Potsdam I had to go with, that's where the German Army Archives were based, and I had to go to Potsdam several times. And although the city itself was badly damaged, it was refreshing to be among people who had, for example, in the whole of East German They had no guns, they had no toys, they had no toy weapons like that. So they had a much cleaner approach to these things, whereas in Germany much more lackadaisical, much more Jewish. And you can see the difference.
The over-representation, which you alluded to just now, of Jews in positions of power in countries, could be called the Jewish question. What do you think the solution to it is?
They should realise themselves that by their hankering for all the wealthy positions, the lucrative positions, that they want to be all the doctors and all the dentists. That's how it used to be in Germany, and that's how it's becoming in the United States again. They have all the doctors and all the dentists and all the lawyers and our Jews. Well, that's one way of ending up being deeply disliked.
So you think they have to take responsibility for some kind of self-limitation, is that what you
Yes. You can't get it's your culture yourself, particularly against the Jews. The Jews don't like cultures. So. But that's a good question, yes.
Well, I was going to say that in Hungary, they did used to have basically positive discrimination which worked against Jews, so they couldn't let so many Jews into university because they were dominated.
When was that, in the post-war period?
Before the Second World War.
Okay, well, that was after Béla Kun and the Hungarian government. In Hungary at that time, they already had a grossly overproportionate number of Jews living in the country. And whenever I see headlines now, say that the Hungarian government, Viktor Orban, is considered to be anti-Semitic. And I say, well, you've got to remember that the Hungarians have experienced the Jews in the past.
But it's a difficult question because they do have a high IQ and they get into these positions, don't they?
Well, that's
so it's a bit like the, you know, we complain about the positive discrimination in this country.
They go too far. In Hungary, at the time of the uprising in Hungary, there were, not just Béla Kun, but the Rákosi, Rival, Gabor Péter, July, all top names there were Jews.
Is it a case of high IQ or is it a case of them looking after themselves?
Yeah, it's networking.
Networking effect does
come. It is high IQ. I mean, it can be as much as 20. About 10 points, it's quite high.
It's a very interesting use of the word networking. That's exactly what high blend networking they do, and you're seeing it now over here in Britain all over again, that they network, and you wonder why suddenly there are so many Jews in the BBC. Well, after their network, and they unfortunately the Indians and people like that, they also network.
Mm-hmm. You also have a culture of expectations as well, that they're supposed to have these things, just expecting them as a chosen people as it goes on with necessary.
But I mean, some orchestras only employ Jews, and I mean, they're just normal orchestras, they just won't employ violinists unless they're Jewish, you know? Seriously, so it's a close shot.
It's their own kind of Freemasonry, yeah.
There was one man I knew who's a brilliant pianist. His name was John Ogden. John Ogden was a pianist who won the Tchaikovsky Prize simultaneously with Vladimir Ashkenazy. The two of them won the Tchaikovsky Prize, both equal number one. And which is the one who got all the concert bookings afterwards. Although they were literally equal pianists.
Yep, that's John interesting. Ogden. Sorry, Dale, you say that, because on Classic FM, all you ever hear is Ashkenazy playing.
Never John Ogden.
That's what I'm saying. You won't hear John Ogden having played because he died about 10 years ago. In fact, it's a sad case, but that's another matter. And I knew him very well. He told me privately, he said, it's the Jews who give all the big jobs, to all the bookings to their fellow Jews. You hear it now across the classic area the whole time.
Yes.
Maxim Wenger. Hosting Maxim Wenger for the whole time. And if you know that Maxim Wenger is a Jew, then that suddenly becomes, you understand why, and you wonder why John Suchet is always boosting him. Yeah. I wonder why that can be. Do you think it's because John Suchet is also a Jew? I don't know. I mean, it's perished thought.
Yeah.
But it's good to know these things and to realise what's going on. I think we can fight back.
So how readily are the Petsy Park transcripts of the communications in the Second World War? So I remember you saying that obviously you've been seen some of them,
yeah.
And they will can both confirm and reject certain accusations about the whole person. But you never hear of anything on the radio or the TV, right?
Well, the Petsy Park transcripts, when they're exploited to the full, which takes very, very detailed work, they make a very, very powerful case of what's going on. They weren't recognised at the time by the code breakers what the transcripts were actually referring to. But frankly, I don't think that the code breakers cared very much, and I don't think the English cared very much. I think Winston Churchill by that time was thoroughly fed up with the Jews. Moshe Sherlock went to see him in August 1944 to plead the Jewish case. He was given very short shrift. And Chaim Weizmann, whose papers were made available to me by the Chaim Weizmann archives, he was first president of the State of Israel. He wrote to Churchill frequently complaining after the war that the Churchill memoirs didn't credit the work that he had done on behalf of the Jews, and why didn't he make more of it? Well, it didn't play very well. So I think that Bletchley Park, the papers, if they're used in full, and I'm using them in full, you have to realize that they too are human beings, and sometimes they can't believe what they're reading, and even when they do know what they're reading by that time, they're so amused by the big numbers that they just... That's all happened on the Eastern Front, doesn't concern us, need concern us.
Henry Hamilton Beamish was the chairman of the British Britain's Publishing Organisation, and spoke in Germany, Nuremberg, January 1937, along with Julius Scott. What do you know about Britain's British people generally, and German, not German?
I know very little about that. I know who he is, and I know what British Publishing was, but I haven't gone into that in any great detail.
Any final questions? No. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
I'll just read a quote from Friedrich Hölderlin's Hyperion. The children of the sun live by their deeds. They live by victory. Their own spirit rouses them, and their strength is their joy. David Irving!
Listen to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.